Welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up tonight. First, in a few minutes, an interview with Richard Seymour, author of the fine new book, The Liberal Defense of Murder, on the relation between the political left, broadly defined, to imperial violence. And then a little after the half-hour mark, an interview with the infamous Bill Ayers, Barack Obama's terrorist pal, as Sarah Palin, remember her, liked to say, on how it felt to be a problem and what all these decades have done for his theory of social change. Before that, some words on the economic news. Because of the holiday, I recorded this on Tuesday, so if anything happened at the end of the week, well, apologies for having missed it. I know that's risky. These days, the world can feel turned upside down in just a couple of hours. But no risk, no reward, or at least that's what the finance profs tell us, especially if you can get the gov to pick up your risk. The housing market lingers in its doldrums. On Monday, the National Association of Realtors reported that sales of existing houses fell by 3% in October. Actually, that's not as bad as it sounds, because the annualized rate in October of just under 5 million house sales a year is about where it's been for the last 12 months. So sales volume, at least, looks to be bumping along the bottom. Prices, though, are falling, and at a somewhat accelerating rate, suggesting a lot of distress sales. My guess is that we've got another 6 or 9 months of this sort of thing before the housing bust finally runs its course, though it could be a lot longer before we see a true recovery. I'd say something similar about the economy, adding maybe 6 months to the estimate, meaning that the real economy may not begin to recover until 2010. But that's just a guess. The leading indexes are still falling. The one from the Economic Cycles Research Institute is falling hard, suggesting a severe recession. Its counterpart from the Conference Board, while also falling, isn't looking quite so scary. But in any case, there's no sign anywhere that the economy, and not just the U.S., but globally, is in anything but the early stages of a major downturn. Next Friday, we'll get the employment report for November. I'm expecting a worse report than what we saw for October, meaning perhaps 300,000 or more lost jobs and a further rise in the unemployment rate. And it may be that job losses earlier this year were even harsher than first reported. The details are too geeky for radio, but there are routine revisions made to the national income accounts every 3 months based on near-complete measures of the job market provided by the unemployment system. These offer an early corrective to the preliminary survey data reported every month. The monthly surveys are based on a very large but still incomplete subset of employers. The unemployment insurance system covers 99% or more of employers. On Tuesday morning, we got those revisions for the second quarter, and they're suggesting much steeper job losses than were initially reported last spring. In other words, we're even worse off than we thought. In some more encouraging news, it does look like the incoming Obama administration plans a seriously large stimulus program, around $700 billion, possibly spread over 2 years. It's likely to be a mix of tax cuts for low- and middle-income households and infrastructure spending, including some clean energy and other environmental initiatives. We'll see what the details look like eventually, but the price tag and the mix are both in the neighborhood of what we need. Obama's announced intention to spend enough to create 2.5 million jobs sounds encouraging, but spread over a couple of years, that's really not all that big a number by historical standards. Still, it would be a lot better than losing that many jobs. And over the last several days, Obama has announced the major figures in his economic team. Like the rest of his appointments, there's not that much change visible. Most are familiar from the Clinton years, though maybe, like good mainstream environmentalists, they believe in recycling. The survival of Robert Rubin as an eminence grise is especially mystifying. He's a guy who blocked regulation of derivatives and promoted the deregulation of the financial system, and was rewarded for his efforts with a senior position at Citigroup, where he urged the bank to take on more risk. The results of that we can see before us today. That's three strikes already, and it's not even a full accounting. The new economic czar, Larry Summers, a deeply obnoxious character, succeeded Rubin as Clinton's Treasury Secretary, and while he's not as directly culpable for financial deregulation as Rubin, he was hardly a whistleblower either. And Tim Geithner, who will move from the presidency of the New York Fed to the Treasury, is touted as having lots of crisis experience. Well, yeah, but it's not clear just how well he's managed that. We used to think that Geithner went along with the current Treasury Secretary, Henry Hank Paulson, in his disastrous decision to let Lehman Brothers go under last September, a decision that helped turn a serious problem into a full-blown panic. Now people are saying that Geithner's just a quiet sort of guy who didn't really approve of Paulson's decision, but went along with it anyway. Who knows? But it sure looks like not only are there no penalties for failure in this society, there can even be generous rewards, but only at a high level. At more modest levels, the penalties can be foreclosure and homelessness. And how about that Citigroup bailout? A big cash infusion from the government on very generous terms, yet existing management gets to stick around. I sure hope the new gang runs a better bailout than this gang, but they've probably been participating in these decisions, so maybe that hope is misplaced. Finally, something I intended to mention last week but forgot. Daewoo, the Korean corporate giant, cut a deal with Madagascar, an island country in the Indian Ocean just off the southeast coast of Africa, to farm corn and palm oil for Korean use in an area half the size of Belgium. Daewoo's rent for this? Zero. Nothing. They're getting the land for free. Daewoo says it's a good deal for Madagascar, since it will provide jobs. That looks like a return to a 19th century model of colonialism, in which private companies get big chunks of real estate in subaltern countries. None of the complex mediations of neocolonialism, comprador classes, international bodies like the IMF, and so on. Just outright land theft. Quite amazing, really. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Richard Seymour. That was Jello Biafra and Mojo Nixon in an update of Phil Oakes' classic, Love Me, I'm a Liberal, which is a nice setup for the following interview with Richard Seymour, author of The Liberal Defense of Murder, just out from Verso. Seymour also runs a blog called Lenin's Tomb, a consistently intelligent and literate site in a blogosphere not known for either characteristic. With so many people looking forward to a major departure from George Bush's foreign policy, which assumes that Bush himself was a major departure from what went before him, this is a good time for a historical fact-check. Seymour's book begins with the Enlightenment in the 19th century, which, although it had many admirable features, also had some horrid ones as well. It's easy to forget that it was Democrats who dropped the bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, founded NATO and the CIA, pioneered the use of death squads in Latin America, and devastated Southeast Asia. But let's have Seymour do most of the talking. Richard Seymour. Welcome, Richard. First of all, before we talk about liberal murderers, why Lenin's Tomb? There's something that sounds a little ghoulish and antiquarian about that.
It is ghoulish and antiquarian, but I think the main thing was that Marx can be appropriated by Wall Street commentators. You know, they can talk about how Marx got certain things right. Trotsky seems a bit too morally pure. Lenin still seems to scare everybody. The name Lenin seems to evoke something. And I think Slavoj Žižek made a point about this a few years ago. The very idea of an effective revolutionary seems to wind people up. And, I mean, the reactions from people, usually blimpish sorts on the right, bear that out.
I think what Žižek said was, when it comes time to shoot people, that's when the dilettantes of Marx get nervous. All right, let's move on, speaking of shooting people. I think a lot of people who don't know a lot of history were perhaps taken by surprise by some of the cheerleaders for the war in Iraq and the broader war against Islamic fundamentalism. The support for that coming from the left, liberals, and even some more than liberals. This has actually a long history, which you illuminate, so let's go back to the era of the Enlightenment and talk about the connection of that with some appalling racist underside.
Well, I mean, I think we can talk about several different strands of the Enlightenment. There was an anti-colonial Enlightenment, there was an anti-slavery Enlightenment, but of course there were also apologists for colonialism and slavery and war and so on. John Locke, for example, devised a theory of property rights that involved at several levels the right to expropriate Native Americans from the land and to colonize it and put it to good use. You can talk about Alexis de Tocqueville, who was, I mean, he admired American democracy. He's certainly consulted today by those who want to make astute commentary about liberal democracy. But he was also, like Theodore Roosevelt after him, of the view that modern liberal states have a sort of mushy quality. They tend to produce effeminacy, and that war would raise national greatness and restore a sort of masculine sense of self-possession. And that's one side of a certain kind of liberal apology for war, although realistically it's hard to see what's very liberal about that. It involves various tropes of racial denigration. Certainly he had no confidence in the ability of non-white people to govern themselves. And then you had people like John Stuart Mill, who was, for all intents and purposes, he was as close to a socialist in British politics as you might get in those times, a supporter of female emancipation, a supporter of extending the franchise to the working class, and yet at the same time he mandated dictatorship and despotism for those races that he regarded as being, if not biologically backward, then culturally backward. And therefore, until they were schooled in the arts of self-government by advanced and enlightened Western states, they implicit obedience to an Akbar or Charlemagne was their lot. So you could talk about various strands in the Enlightenment. I think Kant was imbibed racist ideas for a long time, but then he produced some anti-colonial sentiment that militated against that. So there are lots of different strands, is what I'm saying.
But by the time we got into the 19th century, the liberal intellectuals were very much on the side of hierarchy and imperialism, weren't they?
Yes, that's right. By the time of the 1830s, I think, I mean, there was hardly any dissent. You did get some dissent from the incipient socialist movements, from the Chartist leaders and so on. But the hold of imperial ideology was so deranging that you could get someone like Charles Dickens, a sentimental Victorian reformer, pledging to exterminate, with all due merciful swiftness of application, the Hindu races, or rather the those who had participated in the Great Indian Uprising in 1857. And again, after the Jamaican Uprising, ruminating on the inferior moral type of the Negro, and using appealing to the doctrines of scientific social Darwinism, as he saw it, to justify their repression, because, of course, the Jamaican Uprising, like the Great Indian Rebellion, was destroyed with extreme and brutal force. And I find some historical analogies that emerge quite painfully here, because the extent to which the mainstream British or colonial pro-colonial media manufactured atrocities and demonized the insurgency as being something quasi-pathological, as outside the social realm and beyond any rationality, I think it's very familiar today. And I think it's quite important for people like Christopher Hitchens and commentators of that ilk to regard the collapse of the Iraq adventure as being fundamentally the result of the misdoings of Al-Qaeda and groups like it, and their pathological need to violate the norms of civilization.
Let's stick in the 19th century for a little while longer. How much of the kind of ideology you're citing was just an after-the-fact rationalization for theft and accumulation? How much was how was just invented along with it, or did it precede it? What was the sequence and the relationship of the ideology and the material practice?
Well, I'm quite a vulgar Marxist in this respect. I think, generally speaking, it came after the event, and it was a post hoc rationalization. There is a very good book, and I cite it, by Tony Ballantyne, that deals with the Aryan ideology of the British Empire. And I think it draws out very clearly how it was the economic motives First of all, the need to collect taxes by the British East Indian Company, and the need to understand the texts and the cultures of the locals from whom they were extracting, and the development after that fact of a series of tropes that, of course, weren't predetermined by the economics of what they were doing or by the violence, but which came to basically, it became the reason why there was an empire in the first place. So that was very clearly a post hoc rationalization. You started off with straightforward economic venture, you know, an appropriate venture, and then you develop an ideology of Aryanism in which there had been a precocious civilization in ancient India which had degenerated, and the Aryans who had ruled the place in its period of precocious civilization had also degenerated, largely, they said, due to the effect of Islam, and that the Aryans of the United Kingdom, of Great Britain, were otherwise in rude health, and they had come along to, you know, revive the ancient civilization. So, I mean, that in itself becomes the reason why there is an empire. Strikes me as a very clear example of post-hoc rationalization, but I think that's true of the arguments in favor of slavery. I think it's true of the arguments of scientific racism in general.
As Bob Fitch says, vulgar Marxism explains 90% of what goes on in the world, so you're not going to get an objection from me. There's an explanation of imperialism, which is that it was an attempt to, at least in part, buy off the rest of working class at home in England. What do you make of that argument?
I don't know that it was consciously an attempt by state bodies to buy off, but I think that that became part of its appeal. I mean, it was explicitly brought out by people like Cecil Rhodes, so it's not exactly controversial that that would have been a motive for capitalists at the time, just in the same way as creating a domestic racial order, or rather, well, yeah, creating a domestic racial order and reproducing it over a period of time helps manage the labor force. I think that's particularly true of the United States, but you could say that the United States is a microcosm of the global racial order that the British Empire and other empires in Europe introduced. I mean, they were able to do things to workers in India that they could no longer get away with workers in Britain. So it's not so much buying off British workers as creating as a sort of a hierarchy of treatment so that you can enslave Indian workers in a way that you no longer could. You couldn't indenture British workers anymore. It has clear economic benefits. And management, it helps manage the labor force. I'm dubious about if it's supposed to imply an aristocracy of labor theory. I don't buy that, because that implies just a small minority getting rich and holding the labor movement back, and I don't think that's the right picture. But I think that imperialist ideology in particular was very important for all emerging nation states. And in the case of, you know, for example, Germany, the colonial idea was deeply associated with containing the insurgency of the labor movement and hegemonizing a significant part of the working class. Don't think it's even that controversial.
I'm speaking with Richard Seymour, author of The Liberal Defense of Murder, just out from Verso. And what was the position of the socialist, social democratic left in relation to this kind of imperialism?
Well, it's striking. It's striking that it's the worst assumptions of liberal imperialism they embellished and made even more vicious. So, for example, at the Stuttgart Conference in 1907, you had delegates from the SPD, from the Dutch Socialist Workers' Party, and elsewhere, arguing in favor of colonialism on, you know, the quite vicious grounds that these people were just incapable of governing themselves, that they were, I mean, some of the tropes that were used were fairly conventionally racist. I mean, you would expect them from the far right today. So Van Kol said, well, what shall we do if we really want to have these people govern themselves and help them to develop independently? Shall we bring them a machine and then maybe they'll start a war dance around it? And he got great laughter at the Stuttgart Conference for saying this. Now, the interesting thing is that the anti-colonial position won at the Stuttgart Conference of all the European Social Democratic and Socialist parties, because an Indian delegate was there to make the case that, in fact, it was a highly exploitative adventure and socialism is supposed to be profoundly humanitarian and about social justice. And if the Indians couldn't have their independence, where was the social justice in that? For all intents and purposes, most European socialist and social democratic parties pursued pro-colonial policies. That was true of the French socialists. Apart from a very small segment of the far left, the French left was overwhelmingly pro-colonial. It was true of the Social Democratic Party in Germany. It was true of the Labour Party in Great Britain. I mean, actually, there's some intriguing connections there, because the pro-colonial elements in the Social Democratic Party were often influenced by the Fabians in the UK. So, for example, Edward Bernstein was a great friend of George Bernard Shaw and the Webbs and people of that kind. And when the Fabians produced their manifesto for empire, they were quite clear about saying that, I think in a very memorable phrase, they said that democracy had proved as useless to non-white peoples as a dynamo to a Caribbean. In other words, implying that democracy is a kind of a technology, a cultural state, rather than a political one. And I think that's quite a common assumption on the part of those who would deny the right of independence and self-government to non-white peoples.
And let's not cross the Atlantic. How did an imperialist ideology take root in the United States?
It's quite interesting. It's almost as if, as I think one famous historian argued a while back, the unity of the country at the turn of the 1900s was purchased at the expense both of African Americans and of non-whites overseas, because you get this coalition between liberal northerners and southern, you know, basically would-be slavers, people who really want to reconstitute the old slave order. And it's all around the colonial idea. So although America had been, in some senses, an imperial state from its inception and had conceived of itself as an empire, certainly senior statesmen did, and although the colonization and the genocide against the Native Americans was colonial in form, the real first stirrings of a colonial movement to imitate Europe came from particularly liberal leaders like Theodore Roosevelt and then later from Woodrow Wilson. I think these were the most ardent imperialists, and you have to see their perceptions as being fundamentally rooted in the ideas of race and of social Darwinism, and in particular, you know, just the idea that the best reserves of statehood and self-government had been produced by Anglo-Saxons. And Woodrow Wilson conceded reluctantly that Semitic races might have contributed something to modern ideas of statehood, but the rest, you know, hadn't really contributed anything. And they would need to be schooled by those who had been prepared by God for 1,000 years, namely the Anglo-Saxon race. So you've got a fusion of different ideas from 19th century scientific racism, so-called, social Darwinism, and romantic nationalism and Anglo-Saxon blood theory. One of the most striking examples from the 19th century that I found of an imperial ideology embracing both racism and the ideology of liberation was a New York poet who put into the mouth of a conquered Mexican something along the lines that we must rejoice because our liberator is nigh. And the Saxons are here, our liberation is nigh. That's what he said. So essentially, you've got this strange fusion which recurs throughout the late 19th century and early 20th century, in which, on the one hand, the peoples who are supposed to benefit from Uncle Sam's largesse are denigrated racially, but on the other hand, we are assured, precisely because they have been denigrated and you know, reinterpreted as children or savages, that the that our designs are purely humanitarian and charitable and will lift them up out of their condition. That's an argument, incidentally, that they shared with slaveholders, particularly those who were arguing for slavery once it had already been abolished.
And if we fast forward to the middle of the last century, we get the State Department socialists and the Cold War liberals, who are definitely on the left end of the spectrum.
Yeah, no doubt. And I mean, I think that makes a big difference to the culture of the pro-imperial movement. It's not pro-colonial this time, of course. It can't be explicitly or formally pro-colonial. That idea is gone. But some of the raciological assumptions, I think, that went into the older colonial period have remained. So, for example, you get intellectuals in the Cold War liberal administration, the Kennedy administration, Cold War liberals arguing that we can't really allow these people to have premature independence. You know, engaging with the decolonization process, seeing it as fundamentally a threat, and arguing that these people are, you know, it's a struggle to find enough of them who are capable of governing themselves and who are capable of voting in the right way. And ultimately, we have to somehow intervene to prevent them from being led astray by the depredations of communists. And this was one of the arguments that kept coming up in the justification of the overthrow of Patrice Lumumba, who, you know, Claire Timberlake, the UN U.S. Secretary, ambassador rather, to the Congo, argued was just totally irrational and in hock to a red plan, a commie plan. So you get ideas that, on the one hand, you know, you're arguing against totalitarianism, which supposedly the socialism of the Soviet Union, Stalinism rather, and the Nazism of the German state had some fundamental features in common. On the other hand, you're ignoring another, or rather, you're justifying in part another form of tyranny and another form of oppression, which is the colonial apparatus, the labyrinth of state violence and repression and prison camps and so on that had persisted, and that the United States was doing its best to preserve in some parts of the world or reform in its own interests in the others.
Okay, this sort of sets us up for the war in Iraq. I think a lot of Democrats and mainstream anti-war people think was largely the business of George Bush and a gang of neoconservatives, and with maybe some help from some hardcore Zionists. But actually, there was fairly substantial liberal support for the war at the beginning, wasn't there?
Yeah, and this is more or less what prompted me to write the book, because it wasn't just that you had people of, you know, the ilk of Michael Ignatieff, who one might have expected a fairly conventional liberal. He had supported the first war in Iraq, but then you saw the you had seen the dramatic decline of Christopher Hitchens, who angrily vented against his former comrades as describing them as apologists for fascism, and I think a number of formerly social democratic and sometimes revolutionary socialist people on the left in the UK, for example, that I'm aware of, defected to the pro-war side. And I think the important thing to bear in mind here is that their importance is not that they have any particular... They're not State Department socialists, so they don't have any real access to power. They probably didn't get any money from the CIA or the FBI or anything like that. They instead provided a kind of intellectual orientation, a liberal imprimatur for those making the war, because what had been a right-wing obsession, and really it was an obsession of the neocons to actually invade Iraq and to impose some sort of pro-American state. These arguments kept coming from people like, I guess, Peter Beinart, Michael Ignatieff, Paul Berman, Christopher Hitchens, and a number of others, many of whom claim to have been influenced by the Iraqi exile Canon Makir. These were the arguments that that helped to take it out of the realm of being a right-wing obsession. And they produced an argument that said this was about fundamentally liberating an oppressed people, and that it was also in the context of doing that, destroying a form of tyranny that might actually lead to a sort of Islamist revival. And that further, it was destroying a form of totalitarianism that was seen to be associated with terrorism. And in Paul Berman's case, the argument was that the kind of totalitarianism that the Iraqi state represented was merely just another version of that which animated al-Qaeda, and therefore you have this impressionistic overlap of the war on terror and the war against al-Qaeda with the need to overthrow the Iraqi regime.
But it all partook of a 200-year-old discourse about uplifting the barbarian hordes, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, unquestionably, and actually appealing to various other discourses that had originated in the, you know, the Victorian imperial era. So, for example, you had the arguments in case of Afghanistan about liberating women. Well, this so-called imperial feminism was molded in, you know, the Victorian era. It was then that feminists began to argue that their states should pursue effectively what we might today call a human rights watch policy, ameliorate the condition of women in the colonial societies. But the agencies that they were relying on to do so were guilty of far more grave crimes than the ones that they were directing their attention to. And they never challenged the right of the colonies and the empires to exist. And I think that that's similar to what we're getting today. As far as lifting up the barbarians is concerned, the main trouble is that there was no attention whatsoever given to the agency of Iraqis themselves, except for a minority of exiles who had already aligned themselves to the American state. Ronnie Brauman, the former head of Médecins Sans Frontières, argues in an interview in my book that this is one of the great problems historically of the left, and particularly of the French left, which had been so pro-colonial. This very old idea that people don't have a role in their own emancipation, and therefore you can go in there and more or less expect to foist emancipation on them. And, you know, this has the capacity to generate resistance, and if you have disavowed in advance the possibility that people will not actually appreciate you foisting emancipation on them, then you can just put their resistance down to some pathological disorder, something that it's not connected to the original project. So this ends up with a situation where you can have people like Hitchens arguing that not enough people died in Fallujah, for example, because too many jihadis escaped. Whereas what in fact happened was an atrocious massacre, killing up to 8,000 people and destroying a great deal of the property and really reducing the city to what in the end proved to be a sort of biometric lockdown where everybody was registered and fingerprinted and they had their retina scanned and they were put into forced forms of labor. So it was a terrible atrocity, but not enough people died, according to Christopher Hitchens, because he has already in advance demonized resistance as some sort of pathology, some sort of Islamism that is rooted in centuries of psychological drama, you know.
People who don't accept their liberation have to be dealt with harshly, right? We've only got a couple of minutes left, but any thoughts now that Bush and the neocons are exiting stage right and a gang of presumed liberals, whatever that means these days, is taking their place?
Well, I think I would want to inveigh against a couple of trends. The liberal intellectual response, on the one hand, it's kind of ignoring Obama's foreign policy because there's elements of it that are quite embarrassing, and really it's quite, it's continuous with Bush's foreign policy and perhaps even more aggressive with respect to Afghanistan and Pakistan. But there's another tendency, which certainly we've seen recently in the United Kingdom among liberals of the Houstonite tendency, people like Will Hutton, who are basically arguing that it's probably a positive thing that Obama is such a, you know, he's a liberal internationalist of the old school. He's very much like Tony Blair and David Miliband. I think the trouble is you're going to see arguments in favor of intervening in perhaps in Somalia, perhaps in Sudan, in any number of places, and these people will be quite important. So I think they've had a real boost in confidence, whereas in recent years you've seen a lot of penitent commentary from not only from people like David Reif, who I think is one of the more sophisticated of this lot, but even Peter Beinart, who wrote a very despairing article saying that he'd got it completely wrong. Well, I think that those kinds of people who have recanted in recent years because of the terrible way in which the Bush administration handled the conquest of Iraq will actually get more confidence and will be out there arguing in favor of aggressive strategies, perhaps in Somalia, perhaps in Sudan, perhaps in Haiti, any number of trouble spots.
And that was Richard Seymour, keeper of the blog Lenin's Tomb and author of the new Verso book, The Liberal Defense of Murder.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio.
My name is Doug Henwood, and the program, Behind the News. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Bill Ayers.
All your private property is target for your enemies. And your enemies.
the Jefferson Airplanes, We Can Be Together. Bill Ayers has come a long way from the late 1960s, though that's where John McCain and Sarah Palin wanted to keep him. Ayers was one of the founders of the Weather Underground in 1969, a group with some rather questionable political strategies. But we'll let Ayers talk about those. And about what he's up to now, which is being a progressive educator with an emphasis on the early elementary school years. He's a professor of education at the University of Illinois Chicago. His memoir, Fugitive Days, has just been reissued by Beacon Press. It had the misfortune of appearing in its original edition in September 2001. Maybe we can take it more seriously now. Bill Ayers. So let me start first by asking you, how did it feel to be a problem during the presidential campaign?
Well, it was odd to be thrown up as a prop in the campaign, and I don't know if I was a problem, but I was certainly a kind of an object, and it felt surreal, definitely, for a lot of the time. I have to tell you, I didn't pay that close attention to it. I don't watch television. I don't really listen to much radio, and so it was, I missed a lot, but I have three grown sons, and they kind of monitored it for me and passed things along, so I knew it was happening, but I kind of dissociated myself from it, and I went about doing my work, which is what I really care about.
Did you feel like you had to keep quiet for many months, and now you can speak freely again?
No, I didn't feel that I was quiet for a minute. I taught my classes. I spoke at universities. I participated in the anti-war movement and in other movements. I wasn't quiet. What I decided I couldn't do was to respond every time somebody stuck a microphone in my mouth. And the reason I couldn't is because the dishonest narrative that was being promoted by that kind of two-minute soundbite culture was so profound that there was no way to enter into it. It sucked the air out of the room. So every time somebody would say to me, so are you repentant yet for your terrorist past? Geez, that would take me 3 hours to unpack all the innuendo and implications in that. And I don't agree with any part of it. So the narrative that made me into a monster, the narrative that said that guilt by association is valid, those narratives I didn't want to participate in. So I participated in my own life, as I always do, and I decided that I would wait until the election was over to speak to the mass media, and I did that.
And I'll ask you just one more question about your former neighbor, which is, what do you know about the milieu that Barack Obama emerged from? My impression is that it's kind of a liberal NGO kind of foundation world, and some people are surprised by the conservative cast or centrist cast his administration has taken, but is that the world he emerged from?
Well, you know, the world that I know is the world of Hyde Park and the kind of world of Civic Chicago. And in that world, I think President-elect Obama has always stood out as an incredibly bright person, incredibly smart. And I always used to say of him, he's the smartest person in any room he walks into. And then I had to amend that and say, including the U.S. Senate, a very bright guy and very talented, very compassionate, but also always kind of a moderate with political ambitions, and everyone who knew him knew that. It wasn't a surprise. Chicago, Hyde Park, these are places that have a range of political opinions and ideas. It's a stereotype to say that Hyde Park is a liberal place. It's a multitudinous place. It's got lots of different angles of regard, and it's not a left-wing place particularly.
All right, let's move on to your life and your memoir. You had a suburban upbringing. You dropped out of college, spent some time in the Merchant Marine, which actually is something I did for a very short time, so I felt a common touch there. But how did you get into the world of radical politics from that rather middle American beginning?
I was lucky in the sense that I grew up at a time when the civil rights movement really was defining the landscape, both politically and morally, in our country. And I graduated high school in 63, went off to the University of Michigan, looking for the movement, in a sense, trying to find how to become a person who could be committed to a better world. And Ann Arbor was kind of a perfect place. I found a lot there that drew my interest, drew my attention, and I met a lot of people who broadened my perspective. So it was a combination of growing up in the civil rights movement, being open to new things, new ideas, coming of age at a time when the world was kind of in flames, and opening your eyes meant opening your eyes to a world that was out of order and filled with war and violence and injustice, and people like myself and lots of other young people felt called upon to respond.
Did you watch the politics of the time gradually become more radical? When you entered the political world, was it as radical as it became later as the 60s progressed?
Well, I mean, I think that when I entered into political, I mean, the first political act I remember taking was picketing a pizzeria in Ann Arbor that denied service to black students. And, you know, it's kind of hard to even wrap your mind around today in a place like Ann Arbor, but we picketed, and I remember, you know, I had pledged my older brother's fraternity, and one of my fraternity brothers came along and cursed me out and punched me, and I never felt happier. I felt like, wow, not only do I believe that we should not be racist, but here I am acting on it, and not only am I acting on it, I have to pay a price for it. So I felt terrific, and a year or so later, I went to jail opposing the war in Vietnam, and again, it had the effect of making me see a broader world, see my own world from a wider perspective, and it made me feel like, hey, I'm involved, I can do things. And each year that I was involved in the movement, each year that the war dragged on, each year that the civil rights movement marched forward, I became more connected to a radical analysis of what was going on. I became more aware of the ways that these issues were connected, and I felt called upon to do something.
It's sort of curious, you went from picketing a pizzeria to joining a revolutionary organization. Was just a gradual evolution, or was there some kind of break in your consciousness that made you take that leap?
Well, I tend to think it was a gradual evolution, but I can say for sure that I committed myself in 1965, after I got out of 10 days of lockup for sitting in a draft board, I committed myself to ending this war. And at that point, something like 70% of Americans were for the war. And I set about not only taking lots and lots of actions over the next 3 years, direct nonviolent acts of resistance against the war, but I also started organizing, going door to door, first in the dormitories, later in neighborhoods, and then in working class communities in Detroit. And that was a huge education for me over those 3 years. And I learned a lot from it. But over those 3 years, other things happened. The Black Freedom Movement, large sectors of it came out against the war. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee said no black man should go 10,000 miles away to fight for a so-called freedom he doesn't enjoy in Mississippi. Many other things happened. Certainly King's transcendent speech at Riverside Church on April 4th, 1967. Certainly King's evolution as a political activist, fighting not just for racial justice, but for economic justice and then global justice. All of these things had an impact. Probably the decisive impact was vets coming home and telling the truth about what they saw forced to do in Vietnam. At that point, it seemed to all of us that the war would surely come to a swift end. Lyndon Johnson announced he was going to step down from the presidency in late March of 1968. We had a celebration. We thought we had ended the war. 5 days later, King was dead. A couple months after that, Kennedy was dead. And shortly after that, Henry Kissinger emerged with a plan to expand the war. So here we were in late 1968. We had done everything that one would expect should be done in a democracy to persuade people and to turn the tide, and we couldn't end the war. And I think that was the most radicalizing moment for me, the idea that we'd played by the rules, we'd done everything we were supposed to do, and still the war dragged on. And as it dragged on, 2,000 people a month were being murdered. 60,000 American kids would be sacrificed to that stupid, illegal, immoral war. And 3 million Indochinese would die. So the question, what do you do? And if you're determined to end the war, and you're determined to end the system that caused the war, you take a turn towards radical revolutionary politics.
But revolutionaries are supposed to speak on behalf of the masses, and the masses in this case were not in favor of any kind of radical transformation, or were they even against the war? So how did you reconcile that in your minds?
Well, you know, I'm not sure you're right. I think the masses absolutely were against the war by 1968, and I think that just as in the situation we're living in now, it takes about 3 years for Americans to wise up and wake up to the actions of their government. But I actually felt at that time that the American people were in a revolutionary crisis with their government. I think it turns out not to have been true, but it felt that way to me, and it seemed that way. And looking at it now, of course, we overreached, we overexpected, we certainly our rhetoric was inflamed and overzealous. But I think that the idea that radicals, revolutionaries can speak up both through words and through actions, oppose the powers that be, and in that way organize people to join in a great effort, I think that is still an aspiration that I have, and I think it's the right aspiration.
So how did the Weathermen come into being?
Well, in 1968, as I said, there was a kind of a crisis in the anti-war movement. A majority of the people opposed the war. Most soldiers on the ground opposed the war, but the war couldn't be stopped. So people at that point began to splinter, and they did many things. Lots of people joined the Democratic Party and attempted to build a peace wing within it. Lots of people went to Africa and Europe to escape the madness. People went to communes. People went to factories. And we decided that we were going to build a clandestine organization, that is, an organization that could survive what we thought of as the kind of escalating repression, the coming fascism. And we saw evidence of it everywhere, most pointedly in the murder of Black Panthers. And we decided that we were going to survive that and that we were going to make the war painful for the war makers. And so we built a capacity to do what we called armed struggle, what amounted to armed propaganda, actions against property, never against people. And that's what we did for the next 6 years.
I'm speaking with Bill Ayers, revolutionary, educator, and author of Fugitive Days, just out from Beacon Press. Now, these actions against property, they were designed to, what, prevent the system from reproducing itself normally? I mean, you're not physically going to bring down the government, were you?
It wasn't quite at that level. I mean, they were designed to issue a screaming warning about the war and about empire and about where we were headed as a society. They weren't at anything like the scale of being able to challenge power, but they were an attempt to say, look, we have here the capacity, this big behemoth, this big monster that acts as if it controls the whole world actually is penetrable. It can be opposed. We can survive. And we wanted to issue, a cry of both anguish and despair and also hope that this war could be ended. So we didn't want people to quietly, we didn't want ourselves, but we didn't want anybody to quietly go about their business and not notice that mass murder was taking place in Indochina, not by accident, but by policy. And that's what it was about.
What, from those experiences, would you tell people, maybe young people who are in a similar situation today, see the war in Iraq going on, possibly an escalation of the war in Afghanistan from the candidate who was elected as the peace candidate? What would you tell them? How could they deal with their frustration and maybe approach the issue of social political change more effectively?
I'd tell them two things. One is that the standard by which any action or any activity or any organization should be judged is whether you reached more people, whether you educated more people. And the fundamental educational gesture is one where you learn as well as teach. So I would judge anything you do, a sit-in, a picket line, a mass mobilization, by whether it was effective in reaching people, whether it educated people as to what was going on. That's one aspect. A second aspect is, once you see that something is wrong, the war in Iraq, to take the obvious example, you must act against it. You must do something. And doing something is the first step, and you should unite with others and act, speak up, make yourself heard, make yourself known. And then, and this is a very important aspect, and then you should doubt that everything you did was all that great, that everything you did was all that wonderful. In other words, if you don't doubt, you become self-righteous and dogmatic. If you don't act, you become cynical and despairing and kind of deterministic. So it's that trick is, open your eyes, act, doubt, reassess, rethink, then act again, and then doubt and reassess again. And that's my advice for young people, and I give it out all the time.
Of course, is that today is much more conservative than the 1960s. How would you compare the present historical situation to 40 years ago?
Well, I think that actually there's many things to be hopeful about today. And I think that, you know, in some ways, I've never been nostalgic for the 60s. I think there's something kind of depressing about looking back to a ship that already left the shore. I see young people today as filled with energy, purpose, hopefulness. And interestingly, the largest anti-war demonstration I ever went on in my life was in March of 2003, not in 1968, not in 1970. So the energy is still there. The hope is still there. We have to stop kind of thinking that the tactics or the rhetoric is going to be similar or recognizable. There's a new rhetoric. There's a new generation. There's new hope. But I actually look at this recent election, and I see rising expectations going through the roof. I see kind of a great relief at leaving behind an era of fear and pain and war. And I see a kind of hopefulness that our imaginations can expand. And so the slogan of the moment is, yes, we can. It's up to us to say, yes, we can what? And define that and rethink it and then act on it.
How did you go from being a professional revolutionary to specializing in elementary education?
Well, I've always been an educator. I started teaching. I walked out of jail. The first time I was put in jail, I walked out of that jail into my first teaching job. I'd met somebody in the jail whose wife had founded a free school affiliated with the civil rights movement. And so for me, education, learning, teaching, and social justice have been joined at the hip for my entire life. I don't see them as separate events. I look at the struggles for civil rights as struggles in the schools often. I see the Freedom Schools in Mississippi in 1964 as a great model of democratic education. So it's not as big a shift as you would imagine. I write about the things I've always written about. I write about social justice. I write about education as a means to achieve social justice. And I write about education broadly. I think of community organizing as an act of education. I think of demonstrations in many ways as an act of education. So I don't think of education as walled off in a schoolroom. And that's what I tend to write about: democracy and education, the promise of democracy, and our failures so far to reach it.
I hadn't planned to ask this question, but it occurs to me talking to you that, there's a Foucault's analysis of the school as almost kind of a prison. There's certainly a very potent radical tradition of education that looks at the schooling system as a system of conformity. As someone now deeply involved in the educational system, do you share that critique?
I share the critique, and actually I spend all of my time writing about it, talking about it, organizing around a vision of education that is based on the incalculable value of each individual and the notion that the full development of all is the condition for the full development of each. Foucault's got it just right. The panopticon, the discipline and punish, is very much a part of how education works. But what we have to remind ourselves is that schools and education is contested space. On the one hand, the drive for obedience and conformity. And on the other hand, contesting that, the drive for imagination, curiosity, courage, initiative. That's the side of education that democratic educators fight for.
And, of course, George Bush's lasting legacy is the No Child Left Behind, which is just one test after another. Does this really complicate your task?
Well, the thing that I said about what characterizes education in a democracy has huge implications for all kinds of policy, including testing. The narrowing of success in school to a single cognitive measure is such a travesty in a democracy. So again and again, we have to remind ourselves that all school systems, whether it's Soviet Union or fascist Germany or medieval Saudi Arabia, everybody wants their kids to do well. Everybody wants them to do their homework, show up on time, stay away from drugs. But in a democracy, we have to ask for something more. And that something more is the belief that all human beings are of value and that each has to find a way to contribute, find a way in schools to not only contribute, but to find something of value that they themselves can construct. And that is something that's worth fighting for, something I've fought for my whole life.
You conclude the book with what I believe is a paraphrase of Alice Walker: we must figure out how to become the people we have been waiting for. Could you expand on that?
I didn't know that was Alice Walker. I thought it was Arundhati Roy or Gandhi, or I don't know. It's been said so many times, I guess it could be anybody. But what I mean by that is terribly important to me, and that is that there's an old model of revolution, and that model is that we'll somehow seize state power and wrench it into a different direction. As somebody who works intimately in schools, I can tell you that imposing the so-called better curriculum in exactly the same authoritarian way as the so-called backward curriculum is imposed is to do damage and violence to curriculum, learning, teaching, and kids. So the same is true in society. If we want to really transform society, we have to take seriously the business of transforming ourselves. Nobody's going to save us except us. So we shouldn't be waiting around to see if Barack Obama is going to do this or do that. We shouldn't be reading his mind. We should be saying, we ourselves can begin to build right within ourselves a sense of justice, a sense of community empowerment, a sense of restorative justice, a sense of peace. And as we transform ourselves, we become even more worthy to inherit the new world, which is hopefully and importantly a world of balance, love, justice, peace.
And that was Bill Ayers, caricatured by the right as Barack Obama's terrorist pal. His book, Fugitive Days, is just out in a new edition from Beacon Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this new song from the great M.I.A., part of the soundtrack to the movie Slumdog Millionaire, done in collaboration with A.R. Rahman. This is called Oh, Saya. Till next week, bye.
City girl, 50.